Hello, I'm Malik No Sleep Scanterbury. This is number 0489, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and this is a very special edition of the Stuff File program. Yes, I know last week was a very special show too. We had our annual Meshach and Malik Christmas special, but this show is another perennial. It's our year-ending best of show that features just a small variety of some of the great guests we had on during 2018. There won't be any Stuff File news in this particular edition. It's just going to be snippets of past conversations. We'll also revisit our favorite idiot of the day at the end of the program as well. The guests later, the person who told you this was show number 0489, has a very special connection to this show. I mentioned last week's program and I mentioned the idiot of the day. Well, keen observers will have recognized the name of this week's guest later. It's my nephew Malik, who is all grown up. He's a singer, songwriter, a rapper, and producer. So thank you very much, Malik, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program. Love you. And by the way, for those of you who enjoyed the Christmas show last week, there is a Patreon reward extra for patrons of the program featuring outtakes and a backgrounder on how the Meshach and Malik Christmas special was put together with those little adorable Rugrats. And speaking of Patreon, just a reminder that the Stuff File program is a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Okay, on to the show. During 2018, we had some adventurers who kind of bookended the year we had. Both travel the world to exotic and often dangerous places, and both share their journeys via television. First up, from show number 0441, is George Karunas. He's a renowned global adventurer, storm chaser, explorer, and television presenter. He documents nature's worst weather conditions, and that's taken him around the world. At the beginning of 2018, I saw a picture he posted on Twitter of him standing on an iceberg. It was an amazing shot, and I just had to find out what that was all about, and also what else he'd been working on.
We get these huge icebergs that break off the Greenland ice sheet, and then they float down the east coast off the coast of Newfoundland, and then sometimes they end up in the shipping lanes, like the Titanic. And so I was on this mission. We were filming for a TV show, and we wanted to sort of track and see how fast these icebergs move. And one of the best ways was to climb up on top of one with ice climbing equipment and then place a satellite tracking beacon on one. And of course, the dangerous thing is these things weigh millions of tons and they can flip and crack and roll without any notice whatsoever.
Wow. Now, pardon my ignorance, but is this iceberg moving?
Oh, very much so.
And how fast?
Not very fast. They go with whatever the prevailing currents are. Quite frequently, they end up getting ground out. So sometimes they'll come into an area during high tide, and they'll get wedged, and then the tide goes out, and they end up stuck there. So we went at low tide while this particular iceberg had stopped moving, just to help sort of eliminate the chance of there being rollovers and things like that.
And how often do icebergs actually roll over?
Oh, frequently. As a matter of fact, I was getting ready to go scuba diving around one, I think the day previous to when that picture was taken of the ice climbing. And as I was getting ready to go in the water, pieces of the iceberg are cracking off with this tremendous thunderous sound and smashing into the water more, maybe 40 feet away from us.
So this beacon that you've attached to this thing, first of all, how do you do it? You just don't lie it on the surface. Do you drill down and anchor it in some way? What do you do?
Yeah, absolutely. There are these things called ice screws, and ice climbers, if you're climbing a frozen waterfall, you use these things to anchor your ropes. So I just used one of those, clipped it in, and we tracked the iceberg for several days. It was drifting around Conception Bay off of Newfoundland, and then the signal went dark. So the iceberg either rolled over or melted. It probably broke into a million pieces.
What was the purpose of doing this? Like, what information do you find out about the iceberg or the flow? What do we learn from what you've done?
It was part of a larger TV program. It was an episode of Angry Planet that we were filming at the time, all about how climate change is affecting the icebergs off the coast of Newfoundland. So as the Greenland ice sheet melts, we're getting more icebergs that come in, and it takes about 2 years for an iceberg to travel from Greenland down to Newfoundland. And so we were flying with the Air Force, with the Coast Guard during their surveys of the icebergs. And so basically trying to learn as much as we can and to see how much the icebergs are changing, because they are ending up in the shipping lanes and they can pose a hazard to transatlantic shipping.
Now, every time we talk to you, we talk about literally extremes. The last time you were on the program with us, you were at a volcano, certainly a hotter situation than what you're doing with this iceberg. But you've also done a lot of other interesting adventures. You photographed the tattooed woman in Western Myanmar. Talk about that.
Yeah, that was back in March of the 2017. There used to be a tradition in some of these tiny villages in the hills of Myanmar where the women would get full face tattoos, and the patterns of these tattoos would change from village to village, and the practice was outlawed in the 1960s. And so the women who still had these face tattoos are now getting quite elderly, and this art form and this piece of culture is dying off. So I was part of an expedition to go there, interview these women, do a census of where they live, what villages they were from, the patterns, and photograph and do portraits of all of these women to sort of capture this culturally significant art form before these women literally die out.
And you also went mountain trekking in North Korea. I'm assuming the most dangerous part about that trip is being in North Korea.
What, doesn't everybody do that? Come on.
That was just a snippet of our chat with adventurer George Karunas. If you want to hear more about his treks, including climbing the mountains of North Korea, you can go back into the archives of the Stuff File program and look for show number 0441. And you'll find the archives located at thestufffile.com. As I mentioned, George isn't the only TV adventurer we spoke to in 2018. Phil Kogan is a very familiar Globetrotter. For years, he's been the host of CBS's The Amazing Race, and this year he also added a new gig. He's the new host of the long-running series National Geographic's Explorer. We caught up with him not long ago for show number 0482. I asked him about the change of pace between his two traveling shows.
You know, we shoot 12 shows in 21 days on Amazing Race. We're flying through countries, literally hitting the ground sometimes for 24 hours. Whereas on Explorer, the whole idea is to dig in a little bit, get much more immersive, to go to a spot and then experience what that place has to offer, the people that are there, the passionate things that they're involved in. And so, yeah, it's way more immersive, and we dig in deeper, I guess you could say.
How did you come to be part of this series, this long-running series? It seems like a perfect marriage. You'd think it was something that would happen sooner.
Well, about a year ago, just over a year ago, I was asked to host a show called Earth Live on Nat Geo with Jane Lynch, and we did a two-hour show around the world, 25 different countries, I think. It was a big success to see wildlife around the world live in this spectacle. And I guess that sort of got the attention of some of the executives over at Nat Geo, who then were looking at revamping National Geographic Explorer. And Explorer, as you may know, is the longest running documentary series in TV. It started way back in the mid-80s, and you know, as soon as I tell people that I'm involved with the series, the first thing they do is sort of hum the tune. And so it's an iconic show that I first discovered when I came to America. So I've had a long standing passion for this particular show. And so when they called me and said they were looking for a new host, and they were looking at me or considering me, I was incredibly excited. So it just, I guess the planets aligned and the opportunity presented itself, and it's pretty extraordinary.
Besides being the host, is your input involved in the show? In other words, for the series now, are there stories or items that you particularly wanted to cover?
Yeah, so I am very immersive in everything that I make. So the scripting, the research, I like to dig in. I've never been, you know, from the beginning of when I started, I mean, it's the same on An Amazing Race, where I write the scripts there, I get heavily involved in the research and the locations we're going into. If I was just a talking head, if I was just someone who went out in front of the camera, I would have gone out of my mind a long, long time ago. It's what people see, of course, because that's where, I am in front of the camera. But really, the part that I enjoy the most is digging into what are the stories we're going to tell, where are we going to go, who are we going to talk to. My job really as a host is to be a facilitator, to communicate a story, to make the people that I'm talking to, wherever I am in the world, the stars, to make them shine. I see my role much more as somebody who is there to facilitate the story, to bring the story to life through the eyes of passionate people, more than it is to just be the face of a show.
Getting back to that volcano for a second, how hot was it going down there?
It was not so much hot. We were just surrounded by these gases, which burnt your eyes, and which, you know, this is the reason I had to wear a gas mask. Certainly near the edge got extremely hot. When we got towards the edge and we looked down into the liquid lava, it's one of the few places in the world where you see boiling lava, where you can look at it directly. Absolutely. I mean, it's scorching. I mean, it's the kind of heat that you can't describe. It's the kind of heat that can vaporize things. But we were walking around the crater on the base level, with looking down into the little lava lake. And obviously, every time we got to the edge, that heat would hit us. But the temperatures would fluctuate tremendously depending on where we stood.
When I watched that episode and you were down at the furthest depths, all I kept thinking is, before you went down, I could see on your hand you had a wedding ring, and I thought, doesn't gold conduct heat? What is that going to get down there?
You're an extremely observant young man. You're absolutely right. And as a matter of fact, there was a point where I did feel some heat on my hand. yes, very observant of you. I was wearing gloves a lot of the time because there is volcanic glass. And what happens is you end up with these almost like imagine a glass needle and a lot of glass needles that sort of pile up on top of each other. So they almost, it almost becomes like a cushion of glass, if that makes any sense. And if you put your hand on anything down there, you get these pieces of glass in your hand. So I ended up with pieces of glass in my hand for weeks after. I was still picking up bits of this little of this black glass. So for a lot of time, I was trying to wear a glove to protect myself. But I was also operating a camera at times, and so it was very difficult to operate a camera with gloves on. So I kept pulling the gloves off, and inadvertently ended up with glass in my hand. But you know, this particular volcano that we go into, it's called the Messiah Volcano. It's the mouth of hell, as the locals have referred to it for many years. There's a million people not too far away from this volcano. It's very active, active all the time. And so we were there with the volcanologists who were monitoring this volcano, constantly monitoring this volcano to try to give early warning signs to people living nearby that they need to get out of harm's way. And that was really what this story is all about. And, you know, the whole point of Explora is to really open up people's eyes to the world and the people who, and how people are interacting with the world. And quite frankly, there's never been a better time for us to be doing this series, because we all really do need to wake up as to what's going on. And take comfort in the fact that there are some very passionate individuals out in the world trying to help protect what we have, the resources that we have. But this to me, Explorer right now is more pertinent than it's ever been.
That was Phil Kogan, host of National Geographic's Explorer. Not everybody has lives as adventurous as either George Karunas or Phil Kogan. For some people, the most exciting it gets is playing chess at the bottom of a swimming pool. Yes, you heard me right. We caught up with Eitan Ilfeld, the inventor of diving chess, on show number 0474.
So basically, you're playing chess in a swimming pool. The board is submerged, so it's at the bottom of the pool. And instead of using a chess clock, serious chess players always use a chess clock. Otherwise, if you're in a bad position, you would just basically not move until your opponent gets frustrated. So you have to have some sort of mechanism to keep the pace going. And the mechanism here is very simple. Instead of a chess clock, it's your breath. So basically, you can think for as long as you hold your breath for each move. So you go down, you have to make a move before you come back up above water, and then your opponent, he or she, has to dive back down, and they have to make a move before they reemerge, and so on and so on. As soon as they come up, you go down, you have to make a move, and it just goes on until someone wins. And it's normal chess. You're still playing chess, but you're basically using your breath, and it's quite physically challenging.
Now, do you have to use any kind of special board? I would assume the pieces had to be a little bit weighted down so they don't kind of float away.
Oh, yeah. So over the years, I've improved the customized boards that we use where the pieces are weighted and we've got very strong magnets on the pieces. So there's no way that the piece will, fall over because someone's kicking around and splashing in the pool. I mean, these pieces are very, very sturdy.
Now, it's one thing to create a game, to create something like this, but it's another thing to get people to agree to it. So when you first came up with the idea of this, how did you bring it to others, and how did you get, and how on board were they?
So let me go back a bit to the origin of the game. I've always loved playing chess. I love chess. It's a great game, and there's so many great tempos to play, different variations as well. It's an amazing game. And I'm a USCF chess master, and I've been living in London now for 11 years. Back in 2008, I went to this board game tournament called the Mind Sports Olympiad, where you compete in lots of different games. I went there to play chess, but they had people competing in Scrabble and lots of other new cool games. What was interesting was I found out about all these different games, and I basically wanted to learn and try different things. So I came back the following year and played again, and I tried lots of other games. And then there's this really bizarre tournament called the Creative Thinking World Championship. And that's a very strange thing, where basically you have to come up with a lot of crazy ideas, and you have all these open-ended questions. And it's I guess most of the things are objectively marked, but some are a little bit subjective. And it was in that competition that I came up with the idea of diving chess. Well, I thought, wow, how could I combine two things and make chess more challenging? Also, going back to chess, everybody agrees that it's an extremely cerebral thing. There's no doubt about that. So some people say that maybe it's a bit of a science, but also it's a bit of an art as well. There's a lot of creativity and beauty in the game as well. Chess has a lot of depth. But some people have tried to make the argument that perhaps chess is a sport. And this can be quite controversial. Obviously, being in good shape will mean that you'll probably do better in a multi-day tournament. And if you play in a chess tournament, you get used to playing very long games. So you might be playing two games a day, 5 hours each. You might be 10 hours of playing. So being in good shape is important. There's no doubt about that. But is it a sport? I don't know. I'm not sure the chess itself, regular tournament chess, is a sport. But I thought, what can I do to create a version of it that definitely is a sport? How can I make it physically demanding and play with the idea of time? And that's basically how I came up with diving chess.
That's Eitan Ilfeld, the inventor of diving chess. That certainly shows entrepreneurial spirit. And speaking of entrepreneurial, ever wonder what happens to all that lost baggage out there? Well, there's a company in Alabama called the Unclaimed Baggage Center. Tractor trailer loads of lost baggage arrive at their processing facility to be sorted, priced, and sold. Not only is it a thriving business, but the Unclaimed Baggage Center is now one of Alabama's top tourist attractions, hosting over 1 million visitors a year. On show number 0448, we spoke to Brenda Cantrell, the brand ambassador for the Unclaimed Baggage Center.
Well, we're the only store in America that buys and resells unclaimed baggage from the airline industry. We purchase these items sight unseen after the airlines have spent 90 days trying to reunite bags with their owners. And over 99.9% of the time, they are successful. But it does leave that small percent available for us to purchase through our salvage agreements and bring them back here to Alabama.
Now, this was started by a gentleman and his family, I guess, in the 60s. And he literally started this business out of his house, right?
Well, he did. He started out of a house in 1970. Mr. Doyle Owens had this thrift store idea and a friend up in Washington, D.C. who worked for a bus line. And as the great, you know, entrepreneur story goes, he borrowed $300 from one grandfather and a pickup truck from the other. And he and his wife drove up to buy their first load of unclaimed baggage. When they brought it back here to Scottsboro, they rented a small two-bedroom house here in town and were only open after hours because he still had a day job. But they quickly realized that they were onto something as people were coming from a little bit further out than, say, just Scottsboro. And in the 70s, you know, people had to drive to get here then as well. And so by the mid-70s, they started approaching the airline industry and moved to our current address. Of course, the store, the building itself, has gone through a number of revisions to expand the retail footprint. But this is where we are, and it's where we call home.
Do you buy the bags sight unseen? In other words, you don't know what's in it till you get it?
Exactly. We have no idea what we're getting. And so obviously, when we get these items, we don't sell everything that we purchase. We sell about a third, donate about a third, and throw away or recycle about a third.
What are the types of things that you sell? What are the types of things that you donate? And what are the types of things that you throw away?
Well, we'll start with what we throw away. I mean, obviously, you know, magazines, ripped clothing, you know, things that are not of a family-friendly nature, things that are broken. We're going to throw all those types of things away. And then things that we'll donate. For example, yesterday we did a big donation with an organization called Wheels for the World, and we donated nearly 150 wheelchairs, several hundred walkers, things like that, that people, you have no idea why they needed those items when they got on the plane and didn't need them when they got off. But we try to make sure those go to good use and those will be repaired and sent back out on mission trips. Eyeglasses, we give a significant amount to Lions Club International. There are volume of clothing, household items that we partner with quite a few nonprofits under our Reclaimed for Good program. And then what we have remaining is the items that would quickly turn in a retail environment. So you have electronics, clothes, jewelry. Yes, you still have household and eyewear, shoes, things like that.
I mentioned in the introduction that your facility is also a top tourist attraction. How did that happen?
Well, we're the only one in America. I mean, it's like a Disney World or a Graceland or the giant ball of yarn, you know, on your bucket list. And we're in a number of publications and books that are great for, you know, whether it's a roadside attraction or a must-see in your state or did-you-know bucket list books. I mean, I have a handful of different publications on my desk right now that we're featured in. Had a guest from Hershey, Pennsylvania come down about a month ago that I had the opportunity to meet, that they were trying to go to all the different places in the book, and it was all over the country. And so, you know, people hear about us on your radio program. They see us on MSNBC, or the people from Hershey, Pennsylvania come down and shop with us and go back and tell their friends. And it's just a phenomenal store. It's a fun experience when you get here. And we don't have an online, you know, sales channel, so you have to come here to shop, and we really wow you with our experience, not only from our Southern hospitality, but different things that we have going on in the store to make it worth your while and make it fun.
That's Brenda Cantrell, the brand ambassador for the Unclaimed Baggage Center in Alabama, from show number 0448. There's more of the Best of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, coming your way in just a moment.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
This is a special best of edition of the Stuff File program, looking back at snippets of some of the conversations we've had over the past year. And speaking of conversations, let me take a moment to tell you a little bit about a book that I'm very proud of. It's called Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Written by me and published by Bear Manor Media, it's a compilation of just a few of the myriad of celebrity interviews I've had the pleasure of doing over the years. People like Oscar-winning stars Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer, Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar, a host of TV icons like Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and the ever-popular much, much more. Plus, two guys who left their footprints on the moon. So check it out. You'll find it at Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at BearManorMedia.com. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and also for your e-reader, which means you can download it and start reading immediately. You'll find the links on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So buy the book. What are you waiting for? Okay, back to the best of the Stuff File program. Speaking of books and celebrities, one of the ones I enjoyed this year was My Four Hollywood Husbands, written by actress Joyce Boulafont. Now, if you grew up, like me, watching a lot of television in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, then there's a good chance you watched a lot of shows featuring Joyce Boulafont. You might remember her as Murray's wife on The Mary Tyler Moore Show, her guest starring roles on a myriad of other programs, or her varied appearances on game shows. Her book was one she attempted to write over several years, and it had different titles. So how did she decide on My Four Hollywood Husbands?
Then a friend called about 2 years ago and said, I have the title for your book. And he told me the title, and I said, that is so tacky. That's disgusting. I would never call my book that. I'd never title it that. And then I thought about it, and 2 weeks later, I thought, you know what? That might sell books, and it's a way to go with the story that is much more important to tell than just, here's my life. And it could, because it involves why were there so many husbands. And the why is, it all has to do with alcoholism and my codependency and the effect that had on my children. And that is the main thrust of the story, but within that story is all stories about Hollywood in the glamour years, in the golden years, and also a wonderful love story of my now husband, a husband number four. There's one that sneaked in there that I don't talk about that's too scary. So I just kind of touched on him. So there really have been, sadly, five husbands. But it took a lot of learning and a lot of mistakes until I finally learned about my codependency and how to handle that. And I feel so happy because so many people have written to me and said how helpful the book was to them in their relationship. So if the book does nothing else except that, that makes me happy.
The one thing I noticed in looking through the information is that, again, the fact that we knew you so well, or thought we knew you so well, through all the things we watched on television through the years, and the reality is that we didn't really know you. And I think it's interesting in a world of tabloid fodder news and the likes of we've seen nowadays with social media, that you managed to have a very visible career throughout your entire career, yet personally you managed to stay under the radar.
I did. I always wanted to protect the men that I loved, and I wanted to protect my children, and I wanted to protect my famous mother-in-law from anything that was unsavory and distressing. And then I, as I was writing this, and I thought, you know, it's not good to keep secrets. It's not good to keep secrets in families. And if you have some little tiny notoriety, maybe my story will help other people instead of looking at somebody and thinking, oh, she's always smiling and laughing. She doesn't have any problems. Maybe it would help people, and especially the children who are caught in that web of alcoholism and codependency. I mean, my greatest sadness of my life is that I put my children through any of that emotional distress.
Now, when you talk about alcoholism, are you talking about a situation involving yourself or the various husbands that you've had?
My husbands. But I contributed to it by being a codependent person. I accepted the behavior. And every day I thought, it's going to get better. It won't be so bad. And he'll learn. And if I think it has to do a lot with having a big ego. If I love this person, who I'm sure drinks because they're sad, but if I love them, they won't be sad anymore and they won't drink. Well, that's not true, because it's a disease, and I'm certainly not that much of a wizard at all.
I'm sure writing this book, even though, as you say, it took you a long time from beginning to end to get through to it, I'm sure writing this book and looking at the husbands that you had and the relationships you've had with them, it must have been cathartic for you to do this. In standing back and looking at it, what do you think it says about you as far as the types of men you were attracted to and married?
Well, the types of men that I were attracted to were very creative men. But they all had we all have a dark side, but they had a dark side they couldn't overcome, and they had to cover up and feel better with drinking or pills, and that interfered with our marriage and their attitude towards our children. And what I've learned, well, I learned one really important thing real late in writing the book. I do a show called Remembering Helen Hayes with Love, and it's about an older famous actress and a young actress who becomes her daughter-in-law, and our up-and-down relationship. And I realized that she was trying to help me by saying some of the very devastating things she said about her son, James MacArthur. I realized, I kept thinking, why is she being so mean? Why is she so terrible to him? Why does she say these things? And I realized in writing that she was trying to save me from a life that she'd had with her wonderful husband. She adored Charles MacArthur, a famous playwright, who was a womanizer and an alcoholic. And she was trying to save me from that. But I didn't see that until it was all laid out in the book. And the other thing was, my big ego thinking I could make these people happy, when that's not going to do it. They have to want to be well, and they have to get help, and I'm certainly not a professional person to do that. But so that was, and also I wanted to write it because I was hoping that people who were in the same situation would see, if they have children, the terrible effect that it has on children, and lasting effect. And I just thought, if I could help in that way, but also be telling the story of the golden age of Hollywood and my great love story, our great love story with my husband, Roger Perry, is woven throughout the book, and how he overcame and went to get help, and for 21 years has been sober. So that's why our marriage is so happy.
That was actress Joyce Boulafont, author of My Four Hollywood Husbands. It was a compelling conversation talking to Joyce, so much so that it was one of the rare double-length interviews that I've done on this program. You can hear the full chat on show number 0448. Another rare double interview on the show involved yet another TV icon with a memoir out. On show number 0449, we talked to Marion Ross, who for 11 years was the head of one of TV's favorite households on Happy Days. Her book is My Days, Happy and Otherwise. Marion had been acting for a long time before the show came along, so how different was it to be on a hit?
First of all, we didn't know it was going to be a huge hit. And you know, I was under contract to Paramount Studios when I was 22. So that's my first professional outing, but I've been wanting to be an actress since I was about 13 years old, living in Minnesota. So the fact that Happy Days became an iconic hit because of the Fonz, you know, and that took about the first 5 years, and then it was after that that we realized that we had a hit on our hands.
What is it that you would want to tell people about working on that show that you think would surprise them?
Well, they probably don't know what a wonderful softball team we had. And the softball team was very important to keeping us together, because Gary Marshall, it was his idea to always keep everybody playing ball. And these are young boys. All these kids were like 18, 19 years old, and they were all good athletes and good ball players to begin with. So that was a natural thing to have happen.
And you did Happy Days in front of a live audience, did you not?
Yes, we started on one camera and then moved up to three-camera show, which with an audience out there.
I'm guessing, because I do believe stage is your first love, I'm guessing that made it much better for you as an actress to have the response of a live audience.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Then as we rehearsed all week, you weren't just tied to that specific script. They could see, the writers could be watching all week long, and they could see all your various colors, and they started adapting their writing for what they could see that you could do. It's like they would say to me, Marion, when we do the table read on Monday, read all those girls and read those older women parts, or read all those feminine parts, you know, the extra parts. So I would just knuckle down and really, you know, read the bejesus out of those parts, and then the writers' heads would snap around, look at me, and they begin to write more and more stuff for me.
So how much of Marion Cunningham is Marion Ross, or vice versa?
I think there's probably a lot in there, and that's, in fact, if you're going to do a series, you better do something that is very comfortable and close to you, because you're going to do it every day. And if you go on for 11 seasons, you don't want to be playing a role that's not comfortable. We were all kind of playing ourselves, you know.
I know you've, as I said, you've had a very diverse career, both before and after Happy Days, but was there any difficulty after you finished playing the role of Mrs. Cunningham to find something that was different or challenging to you, because you had played that role for so many years and people saw you in that role?
Right. You feel compelled to prove that you're an actor. So what I did was I went to the Globe Theater in San Diego, went back to the stage as fast as I could get an opportunity to go back to the stage. Yeah, it's always, you don't want to get locked into anything. And then I had the good fortune of being in a series that was a very short run, I think we made 36 shows, and it was called Brooklyn Bridge for Gary Goldberg.
Right.
And I played a Jewish Polish grandmother. So that was a real stretch. I was amazed that I was finally able to nail that part. And because I am really a character actress, I'm an actress, you know.
Now, you mentioned character actress. Is that something you've known you were all along? Because sometimes people evolve into character actors. Some people begin as character actors, and some people kind of step away or try to step away from being a character actor because they want to be the ingenue and the star. So was something...
Yes, you can get kind of locked out of some of those good roles, and that's a shame. No, because I was such a serious actress. If you read my book, you're going to see, when I was in Minnesota, I would go to the library and read Who's Who of Famous People and read the lives of actors. And I only wanted to go to the stage, to go to Broadway and become a stage actor. So, like a real actor. And a real actor is where you totally lose yourself inside somebody else. You know, I wasn't keen on being me. I wasn't a raving beauty. I wasn't, but I loved being somebody else.
You had great times doing that show, but it wasn't always hearts and roses. You didn't always have the warmest relationship with Tom Bosley, correct?
No, and you know, it's interesting. Tom Bosley, when he was like almost 26 years old, had gone to Broadway from Chicago and won the Tony. I mean, and he played Fiorello on Broadway. And so he had made his mark. So he's a big, pretty big guy. He, I think, must have wanted somebody else to play his wife on this series. So he was not very impressed with me and was tough on me. He was tough on me. And I'm not much of a tough guy. I I'm not good at protecting myself. If I had been a little more sophisticated, I could have handled him, you know, but I couldn't handle him very well. So it was a journey for me, you know.
Well, you did work with him though for 11 years, so you must have softened him up.
Maybe 4 years were pretty tough going for me, because I was kind of a patsy.
Really?
Yeah. You wouldn't believe it, but...
So what do you think softened him up later on? Because you said it was the first 4 years that was difficult. At some point, he must have agreed you were his equal as an actor.
Well, I think he could see that I was more capable and everything than he thought, because I was not somebody that had a name at all. So I had to constantly prove myself to him. And it was just a tough period. In fact, I remember one time the Fonz said to me, Henry Winkler said to me, Marion, for some reason, this is all your fault. And I thought, I hear you. What is it that I do to Tom that makes him want to go and get me, you know? He just wanted to get me good all the time. So somehow we all grew out of it, whatever it was, you know.
That was actress Marion Ross of Happy Days fame. Her book is My Days, Happy and Otherwise. This was another double interview, so you can hear the whole conversation by going back to show number 0449. We have more of our special edition of the Stuff File program, a best-of retrospective look at some of the conversations we've had over the year. I'm Peter Anthony Holder. We'll be back in a bit.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. In January of 1776, the great American patriot Thomas Paine published a short pamphlet called Common Sense that helped spark the American Revolution. This January, as we think about our goals for the coming year, it's useful to revisit this historic document and hear what Paine told his fellow colonists. In his opening paragraph, Paine wrote, and I quote, "A long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right, and raises at first a formidable outcry in defense of custom," end of quote. In today's language, what Paine was saying is that it's easy to lose sight of how wrong something is when it becomes an everyday part of one's life. Let's be fair, frivolous lawsuits have become such an everyday part of American life that it's easy to lose sight of how much they cost us by increasing the cost of everything from health insurance to consumer products. Instead of defending the status quo, let's think about how we can improve things. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
Welcome back to a special year-end edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. This is our year-ender, the Best of the Stuff File program, featuring snippets of some of the conversations we had this year. There was a time when you drove through many neighborhoods, or any neighborhood in North America, that you'd eventually pass at least one Blockbuster video store. But those days are gone. In fact, in the United States, there is only one remaining Blockbuster outlet. It's located in Bend, Oregon. Back on show number 0471, we spoke to Sandy Harding, the general manager of the last Blockbuster video.
We were a franchise prior to all the stores closing, and so Dish Network allowed all the franchisees to sign a licensing agreement and stay open if they opted to when they closed the corporate stores. And we took advantage of that, and we signed that agreement and stayed open. And I think that, at the time we had 5 stores when that happened. And of course they've kind of dwindled down. We've lost a couple of leases to, longer term tenants and different things. But I think Bend is just really special. We get a lot of tourists. We have a lot of people. It's one of the fastest growing areas in the United States. So we have a lot of people moving into the area that are super excited that we're here. And, on a regular basis, we probably set up 2 or 3 accounts a day. And so now with all this added hype, it's definitely pushing us up over that next level.
One of the things, of course, Netflix has taken a big hit into the business of videos. I mean, that's one of the reasons. And we can think of all the reasons why this is something that has died out. It's like you're the last person making buggy whips. So having said that, you have a clientele, you have a base. What do you attribute that to? And are you concerned that even though you might have the fans who want the videos, you might run out of the actual physical product itself?
No, I go out and buy new movies every week. And we do still have one vendor that services us out of Portland, but we get, quite a bit of our new releases. But no, I'm constantly out buying movies and whatnot every Tuesday morning that you can see me out buying movies. And as far as Netflix goes, that definitely played a part early on when Blockbuster closed all the corporate stores and whatnot, and we watched everyone else struggle. And I think that it's finally settled down to the point where there's room for both of us, and most of our customers have Netflix and or some type of streaming at home, but they still see the value of coming in and talking to us and get out of your house and having that face-to-face interaction with someone and touching movies rather than just scrolling through your television.
Well, you talk about the value of coming into the store and talking to you guys. So what kinds of, what do you look for when you are hiring? Because you say you're now in the process of hiring. It's got to be very service-oriented for you to have survived this long and be the only one surviving.
It is. And, I've been here 14 years, and one of the kids that work here is my son, actually. He was 3 when I started working here, so he grew up in the store. And most of our customers know my employees that have been here a long time. And I have, probably 4 or 5 employees that have been here, 5 years or more. And so we know the customers know us, and they really appreciate the fact they come in and get the same service, every day. And so as far as hiring goes, I look for people who like movies. But just people with very outgoing personalities who want to work, who love their job and can be, little Blockbuster cheerleaders and, really out there and letting people know how wonderful it is to be able to still work here.
It's almost like going to a funeral and then looking at the oldest person in the room and thinking, how much longer do you have? It's a rude thing to say, but having said that, do you ever concern yourself with the fact that you're the only one standing? How much longer can you last?
Obviously we do. And we still have a few years left on our lease. And this location's been here since 1992. So we have a great relationship with the landlords and with the community. And people know that we're here. We've been here a really long time. And but of course, when I first came to work for Ken and Debbie, I had never worked in the movie business before. And I remember Ken kept telling me, we've got a couple more years left. And so at some point I'm like, well, those couple of years are going to run out. at what point is that couple of years gone? But, with this added hype, it's the one thing that is done for us that has been fantastic is it's reminding everyone that's local that hasn't been in for a while to rent to come back and help support us so we can stay being the last store. And so with that, I think we have no plans on closing, and we're just going to keep doing what we're doing like we always have, and we'll just see what happens.
That was Sandy Harding, the general manager of the last Blockbuster video on the continent, located in Bend, Oregon. She was on show number 0471. We go from one story featuring the last of a kind to one that definitely features one of a kind from show number 0466. A Vancouver man who sold hot dog water for $38 says he did so to prove a point about the marketing of health claims. Douglas Bevins promoted himself as the CEO of Hot Dog Water and had a booth at an annual car-free event. Did he actually think he would sell any of them?
We had about 30 bottles that were ready to go. I'm just thinking back to the grant that I was writing at the time and some of the wording that I used. I think I put that I didn't really care if I sold one bottle of hot dog water, that it was really about getting people talking about it, you know, just in its absurdity, just getting people discussing it and getting them to reflect on their own vulnerabilities to product marketing.
So were you surprised at the amount that you did sell and also the media reaction that you have since received?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I thought for sure there would be some local media coverage, but I didn't anticipate it being a worldwide talking point, that's for sure. But I think that illustrates that we're in an era of collective vulnerability when it comes to product manipulation. And, you know, with social media's targeted marketing and clicks and likes, and I think that just now there's a zeitgeist, and that's why it took off the way it did, is because I think what I presented was just an example of how everyone is feeling right now about products and celebrity endorsements and just like what the heck is real out there, you know, like you just never really know.
Now, if I have this straight, you boiled basically 100 organic beef hot dogs and put each one in a bottle of water. You then sold those unfiltered water bottles for $37.99, but two bottles could only cost you $75, so there's a bargain there.
Yeah, it was a Father's Day deal.
Father's Day deal. The thing that I find rather interesting is that not only did you sell several of these with a phony health claim, but mm-hmm. didn't you hear back from people who claimed that whatever it was, however it was they used it, it worked?
Yeah, well, we were rubbing the lip balm. We had different health hot dog water products. So we had breath freshener, hot dog water breath freshener, and lip balm. And we were actually massaging some of the lip balm into the crow's feet of some of the people as part of the demonstration. And they were coming back later suggesting that they actually looked younger. There was also a gentleman who rubbed it on his balding cap. He sent me an email later, said he was pretty sure there was some growth. So you got to question the claims that are being represented, and also the claims of the people who are have these anecdotal stories that come after.
Okay, so now that the word is out, I mean, you're getting a lot of media attention for the fact that obviously this is something that is not true. Have you heard back from any of the people who swear that it is true?
No, I haven't. The most recent thing that's pretty hilarious to me is that there is a cooking magazine. I can't remember what it was, but they did an article on hot dog water and my project a couple of weeks ago. But now they've solicited from their foodies, like, what can we actually do with hot dog water? And there's an article on what you can actually do with hot dog water, like for real, which is pretty hilarious to me.
After all this is said and done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you went into this project with an idea of what might happen, what it might say about people or not say about people. Now that you've had the results that you've had, what do you think about all this?
I think it's a general feeling that everyone is susceptible to right now, this bombardment of information and product manipulation. I don't think there are enough checkpoints with people who are claiming things, like, you know, all the raw water stuff and all the smart water and Gwyneth Paltrow's health stickers and all that stuff. Like, who is checking on that stuff? Somebody needs to be. And if there was, I feel like we would feel less vulnerable, like a watchdog of sorts.
So how do we change that? Is it an easy fix, or do you think this is a long slog?
Well, I think that's where art comes in. You know, art has a way of making you think way beyond what a public service announcement can. I mean, now that it's gone viral I think most people, not most, but many, many people have seen hot dog water, the bottle, and this hot dog floating in this hot dog water. And they have that image stamped on their brain. And I'm certain that there are thousands of people that will be going to, you know, the grocery store or to the pharmacy and looking at products and going, and it'll click in their brain, like, is this hot dog water what I'm about to buy? So I think that's where art can be way better at communicating ideas than if the government did a 2-minute or a 10-second broadcast about it, like, beware of false claims or something. Like, it's way more powerful if you're doing a artistic implementation of a message.
From show number 0466, that's Douglas Bevins, the CEO of Hot Dog Water. Now, I did promise you a favorite idiot of the day to end things off. We went back to a show in April. That's number 0453. Let's get to it. Time now for our retro idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff off presents the idiot of the day.
Police in Georgia shared security camera footage of a GameStop store burglar who tried to conceal his face with an unusual disguise, a clear plastic wrapper. The St. Mary's Police Department posted video to Facebook showing security camera footage of the burglary. The video shows the male suspect wearing a plastic wrapper from a package of bottled water over his head, completely failing to hide his face with the clear plastic. Police asked the public for help identifying the craftily disguised gent, that was their terms. On their post, they wrote, "You can help us catch him once you stop laughing." Well, needless to say, the cops were quickly able to put a name with the face. 22-year-old Kerry Hammond Jr. was arrested and booked on 2 felony charges by Camden County Police. Now, why? Oh, why would you think that covering your face with clear plastic was going to be a proper disguise for committing a robbery? Well, there's probably 2 reasons here. 1, you're the only person who can't tell the difference between Clark Kent and Superman because of his glasses. And the other reason? You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0489. Hope you've enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0489. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberstationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.